Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Just in time before they have to, you know, not saddle up. They're not horses, but they got to get the reins and they got to get the bells on and they got to start doing their practicing in flight. I'm talking about reindeer, and who better to talk to about these incredible creatures than I call you kind of our animal expert, Greg. Whenever I have questions about any animal species, I'm like, you know who will know? Greg Dantrow of the Beardsley Zoo, executive director there at the zoo. And he is here right now to talk all about reindeer and just deer in general. Hey, Greg, how are you?
Good morning, Melissa. This is one of my favorite days of the year.
Why?
Winter solstice.
Oh,
every
winter
day
solstice.
After day.
I know. Well, it's one of my favorite days. One of my favorite people on the planet was born today.
Oh, really? Well, that's great. That's always good too. But tomorrow, it's getting longer. Days are getting longer.
I know.
Starts
that's
towards
that's
summer.
True too. Once you get through the shortest day of the year,
it's
you're just
Done
going
deal.
Up from here. That's true.
It's all
that.
going uphill.
Love that perspective.
Going uphill.
Greg,
yeah, reindeer. Reindeer go uphill too.
Yeah, they do.
Reindeer are cool.
They're really, really cool, actually.
Yeah.
Let's talk about reindeer. I mean, the animal in general, obviously, because you've got the characters, but in real life, reindeer are pretty amazing.
Reindeer are an amazing, amazing species, and they're not an endangered species. The reindeer and caribou are basically the same. They're the same under the same Latin name of Rangifer tarandus. So they basically are the same species. However, caribou are the wild species, wild of the group. Reindeer are the domestics. So
oh,
if any domestic,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, so we have caribou in North America. We have caribou up in Canada, but we don't
call them
reindeer.
And we have them in the North Pole, because if you've watched the Polar
right.
Express, they
exactly.
block the track.
Exactly.
Caribou,
exactly.
You know, so, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But if they are a wild species, if they're not being domesticated, then they are called caribou. If they're actually being worked, if they can be used for, and the peoples up in the North areas will definitely use these animals for everything. They use for milk. They milk the reindeer.
Time out. Have you had reindeer milk before? Wait a second.
I have not. That's one of the things. It's one of the rare things I've not had. But reindeer milk is probably one of the most great stuff to drink.
Wait,
I mean, it's
Greg,
got.
We need to find reindeer milk. All right. While you're talking, I'm going to do a Google search. Where can we get reindeer milk? I'm not even joking.
We got to find out where you can get reindeer milk. Yeah,
I'm working
on it. Reindeer milk is tremendous because, again, up in the north, anything that sustains people, it's got to have a lot of fats. It's got to have a lot of protein. It's got to have a lot of good stuff in there. So reindeer milk is tremendously great for the people that, again, work with reindeer as part of their livelihood. They herd reindeer. They can have up to 100,000 reindeer in a herd, which is tremendous. Did you know that reindeer also help with climate change, help keep climate change down?
How is that?
People
even
don't realize.
How
is that possible? How is that possible? Well, the great herds of caribou and reindeer up north, what they do is they keep the ground clear. They will, this thing called shrubification. It sounds like
a
made-up
word.
Are they
like the winter version of goats?
Well, exactly.
Okay.
Or sheep, right?
Or sheep,
what they
right.
do
whoever's
is,
cutting the grass, right.
right. They eat lichen, which we have in our own backyards here in Connecticut. But they eat lichen, and what they do is they mow down all of this, anything that's growing. You know, they keep it down. And if they keep it down, shrubification sounds great because it sounds like it makes the area more diverse. What it does is it keeps the heat in. And if up north, especially, if you keep the ground clear, when the snow gets on it, it reflects the heat, right? Snow, the white reflects the heat up. And while it does that, it keeps things colder. So if the reindeer and caribou weren't up there, then we could have more warming up there than we already have. So it's a kind of interesting thing that reindeer actually help with climate change.
Okay,
or
so
keeping climate change.
That's amazing.
In check.
And also really quick, Greg, if you're ready to get in the car and you know, during the busiest travel time of the year, if you want to drive up, we could carpool if you want. We can head on up to Orleans, Vermont. We could go there.
And that's where they have reindeer milk?
Well, they've got a reindeer farm there it's literally called Vermont Reindeer Farm. Very, very straight to the point. But yes, it sounds like not only can you meet them, but you could see them in action. And it sounds like they do sell reindeer milk. I want to know if they ship it. I really want this.
The Sami people, what they do is they use every part of a reindeer. And it says, again, it's basically like a cow for them. In fact, when we talk about they use the fur, they use the meat, they use the milk, and basically use the entire animal for their survival. And when we have white-tailed deer around here, we call them bucks for the males, does for the females, and fawns for the babies. Reindeer, they actually use the same terms as you would use with cattle. The reindeers, the males are bulls, the females are cows, and the calves are the babies. So they use that names for them like cattle. What's interesting about there's so many interesting things about reindeer is that they actually have their hooves will change during the season. So you know, the hooves are in the summertime, their pads are very swelled up because they're walking through very marshy areas, so they have splay out to keep them sinking down in. Wow. But in the wintertime, those pads shrink up. And as those pads shrink up on the bottom of their feet, the hooves get more sharp, which means they get more traction in the snow. So it's that's an interesting adaptation. The females and males both have antlers. The females are smaller. That's different than our white-tailed deer in Connecticut. The does do not have antlers. The males have antlers. And I can't say everybody, when they say horns, it makes me crazy. But antlers. These are not horns. Yeah,
the rhinoceros has the horn. I don't know.
That's right.
Very
exactly.
Different. Come on now.
Cows have horns. Cars have horns.
Yeah.
And their hair is hollow for insulation. Of course, it's very cold up there, which gives them a white color.
So like when you pet them, they're not soft.
No, they're not soft. It's kind of coarse.
Okay.
And polar bears, too. Polar bears have hollow fur.
Really? They're not fluffy.
And they have hollow hair. And because, again, that's for insulation.
It retains the heat.
And that's what makes polar bears white. Yep, yep.
Interesting.
They really can't fly. We don't see reindeer fly except for, of course, on Christmas. But they are great swimmers. They can swim up to a mile and a half because that hollow hair also gives them buoyancy. So they
can
swim long distances, especially up north where they have to ford across great bodies of water to move to other grazing lands. So they will swim across these bodies of water. White-tailed deer also can swim very well.
I didn't know that.
We've seen white-tailed deer swimming across Long Island Sound. Now, you would think that's 18 miles, and some 12 to 18 miles.
Yeah, but that's incredible stuff. I had no idea that they were swimmers.
Yeah, white-tailed deer can swim very, very well also. So, again, they don't have hollow hair, so they have to really work a little harder to swim through that area.
Wow.
And what's interesting also, another interesting thing, they can see ultraviolet light. Reindeers can see ultraviolet light.
See,
that helps them because they don't have sunglasses up in the North Pole, up in the north, when the snow's on the ground. And everybody knows when the snow's on the
ground. Oh, it's so bright.
You talked about this morning, if we ever see any snow again. But that with the snow on the ground, it hurts your eyes. But reindeer have ultraviolet sight.
So they have, like, built-in ski goggles, basically.
Exactly. Built-in ski goggles to be able to see. So, again, all these really things, it's really cool. The calves can run as fast as the adults. As soon as within 3 hours of they're born, they can keep up with the herd. So they're born and it's time to go because these herds move. And so the calves are born and they start moving immediately. And that's why they're not spotted. Now, again, the white-tailed deers in Connecticut, the fawns are spotted. They lay very quietly in the grass, when mom's out there feeding. Again, that's what a lot of problems that happens with people. They see these white-tailed fawns in the grass and they look around for the mother and the mother's not there. And they think, they must be abandoned and then pick them up. That's the worst thing you can do, especially when they're starting to give birth in the springtime. Mm-hmm. Leave those babies alone. But the reindeer are not spotted. And the reason they're not spotted is because they don't need the camouflage because they can get up and run with mom. Mom doesn't have to care about hiding the babies because the babies are moving along with them.
Amazing. Off. Wow.
Exactly.
I'm telling you, we knew that reindeer were magical in the stories, obviously, that we hear about them with Santa Claus. But in real life, reindeer are actually magical. I want to keep talking about them, Greg. I'm very fascinated. I also feel like we actually need to find you reindeer milk. You know way too much about reindeer to have not tried reindeer milk. So
reindeers are better than people. Sven, don't you think that's true?
Yeah, people will beat you and curse you and cheat you. Every one of them's bad, except you.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
But people smell better than reindeers. Sven, don't you think I'm right?
That's once again true, for all except you.
You got me. Let's call it a night.
Who can forget this fantastic song about how reindeer, they're just the best. They really are. If you're wondering where that's from, of course, Frozen. And,
of course.
But it is true. You know, we were having this conversation not too long ago. One of my colleagues and I were talking about this in the studio, and he was like, oh, by far reindeer are better than people. So here we are. We're talking about reindeer, of course, because we're just days away from Christmas. And Greg Dancho, who is like our animal expert on the show, he is the executive director at the Beardsley Zoo. He seems to know an awful lot about reindeer. Now, here's my question, Greg. Do reindeer have to live in colder temperatures?
They can live in warmer temperatures. And again, there are some areas around here that have reindeer or caribou year-round. We see reindeer or caribou in the wintertime, and they're magnificent. The males have very large antlers. The females, not very, very large. And they have them up for breeding purposes, of course, and fighting for females. And then they lose those antlers, actually, in November. And then in the springtime, they start to shed their fur, you know, and they kind of look not the magnificent reindeer that you see during, you know, Christmas time. If you have reindeer or caribou in areas around here, they just don't look very well. Also, sad to say, reindeer or caribou can pick up a disease from white-tailed deer.
Oh, no.
Really get that up. It's called wasting disease. Which they can get, and they just don't do well, and they do pass away from it. And they can also carry it. So we don't usually can bring in what reindeer into Connecticut without getting permits. So if we want to bring reindeer to the zoo, we'd have to get permits of a reindeer herd that's been shown that they have none of this disease.
Have and
if you have
them
here, they can't get near any white deer. We've had reindeer in the zoo years ago.
Oh,
yep, years and years ago.
That.
We did have reindeer at the zoo. We had young ones, little ones here, which we had for the winter months. We have not done that for a while because, again, we want to make sure that we're safe with the animals when we bring them in.
Yeah.
So we have not done that for a while. We may bring it in the future. But, again, that's what you have to watch out for. You have to watch out for these animals coming down here. And also, again, some of the, they really want to be in a cold weather climate. So their fur when they're when it gets so hot down here, it gets hot up in the north too. But it gets hot up in the north too. But the humidity is what really gets is.
Oh well, that's what I meant by like hot. I mean, I remember living in Burlington, Vermont, and even on an 85 degree weather day, it was never humid. There's not as much humidity up there as there is down here. Yeah.
You had Frozen on a little bit ago, but you know that in Frozen 2, the tribe that they had the Enchanted Forest for those people that watched. I mean, you watched that many, many times. those people were actually based on the Sami people, who are the reindeer herders of Norway.
Oh,
so those were actually people. They based it on those people that do use reindeer to pull sleighs. So reindeer are, just like Sven, you know, that we see in there, that's actual what happens in Norway. They do have the reindeer pulling the sleighs.
That is so cool.
So again, and it's just even adding something more to it, that reindeer do have red noses like Rudolph.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they've got so many veins circulating the blood around their nose because their nose is open, you know, there's no fur on there, and they have to keep breathing, that heating up the air they breathe in. So those blood vessels around their nose actually gives them red noses.
Is that why some dogs will get that too, or no?
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly, same thing. The noses are have to keep, as you're breathing in, you have to keep breathing in warm air. You can't get that frozen up. So your noses do have a lot of blood vessels going on there.
Interesting.
Some people have red noses, but we don't. That's probably not the same thing.
It's a little bit different. Yeah, just a little bit. Well, reindeer are better than people. You know, Christoph said it perfectly.
We heard about that.
I heard that before, I think. Well, I think this is really interesting, Greg. I know more about reindeer in the past 20 minutes than I ever did in my entire life. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. And if you ever think a reindeer could sneak up on you, they really can't because they have tendons that when they walk will snap, and they make clicking sounds when they walk. So if you're with a big herd of reindeer walking by, it just sounds like clicking and clicking and clicking and clicking. And if they make any noise at all, they grunt. So Sven has his reindeer. I can't remember what his reindeer's name is. You know it.
Santa?
No, no. It's Frozen.
Kristoff. Yeah.
Now, he grunts. That's what reindeer do. They grunt. They make very large grunting noises. So they grunt and they click when they walk through big herds.
Yeah.
So they can't sneak up on you.
That's okay. Because Kristoff gets a little scared anyways. He gets a little nervous. So that's probably better. I'm telling you, Greg, I know exactly what to get you next Christmas because I can't turn it around this quickly. But I definitely, the next time I go to Vermont, whether it's before Christmas or not, which will probably be, I am definitely going to get you reindeer milk. I want to know what it's like, too. But I'm definitely going to get you that. You have earned at least two bottles of it, for sure.
Yeah, give me the chocolate variety.
Okay, well, now you're just getting too picky. I mean, now you're just getting a little ridiculous, honestly. No, you're worth it, Greg D'Angelo, I tell you. And I hope you and your family, your beautiful family, have an amazing Christmas. I can't wait to continue our Zoom Minutes just going forward. Are you going to be here next week or no? Are you off?
I will be here next week. Yes,
fantastic.
I will be here next week. So I want to wish everybody and you and your family happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Again, to everybody that's visited the zoo this past year, as we get into 2024, I appreciate everybody that's come to visit us and see the animals and learn about what we do here. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you having me on to talk about
Greg,
it.
Greg, don't get sappy.
Really, really
wonderful. No, Greg, we're not doing that this week. No. We're sticking with Christmas. Next week we can cry together. Not today. We're not doing that. No.
All right.
We should do something fun though next week, Greg, and talk about some of the highlights of 2023 at the zoo. Like if you want to start working on that.
Let's start putting that. I'll work on that.
Cool.
That'd be great.
Cool.
Anybody has any questions, begin. Fill them in. All right.
I like that. I love that. Greg D'Angelo, thank you so much. Have a Merry Christmas and we will talk next week.
You too. Everybody have a Merry Christmas.
You're the best. Greg D'Angelo of the Beardsley Zoo right here on WICC. I was reading an article in Hearst Media recently, and it talks about how cursive writing is going to be encouraged in the classroom. This is actually a law that's going into effect January 1st. And I wanted to talk about cursive writing and sort of the controversy that actually has been surrounding it for many years, whether or not it is necessary. Do kids really need to learn it now that it's not a required skill to be taught in schools? Are we holding things back from our kids? So I wanted to get some perspective on this from none other than one of our education specialists on the show, and that is Fran Rabinowitz. She is the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. Fran, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you, Melissa, and I'm fine, and I hope you are too.
I am, thank you.
A little bit busy, crazy at this time of the year, but okay.
I can't imagine why. It's so funny. I see so many, and I'm obviously joking, I see so many videos of teachers who are like just counting the seconds for that last bell tomorrow to ring so they could get a break. I was picking up my son yesterday, and his teacher's the best. He's got the best kindergarten teacher on the planet. But it was so funny because he had a doctor's appointment, Fran, and you can relate to this. And so I go to pick him up at 1 o'clock. I say to the teacher, I'm going to bring him right back. He's just got to do a quick follow-up to check if his ears are okay. Now, mind you, he gets out of school at 3:30. The teacher goes, no, it's fine. Just keep him. It's fine.
Just keep him.
One less I got to worry about. And what's funny is my son is really not a problem child. I mean, the teacher's told us a million times, but you could see that she's, you know, everyone is like, we're ready for our break to start. So I can only imagine how busy you are.
Everyone that I talk to is just ready for a break, Melissa. And, you know, I remember my own days as a teacher. Oh, my goodness. Those last days were just so hectic and crazy that by the time school was done, it was like you just breathed a sigh of relief. So I get it. I totally get it.
Well, and the kids are nuts. I'm sorry. Listen, my own kid who's pretty chill, they're nuts. They're excited for everything. They're having way too much sugar. I mean, they're crazy. And the poor teachers, you know, we're like, here you go. Enjoy the next 6 hours. I mean, it's wild. So pray for your teachers.
So, you know, it's just a crazy time of the year. People are so busy anyway, and then you add the whole holiday piece to it, which is beautiful and wonderful, but it does come with its stressors.
Oh, absolutely. No, so that's why I very much appreciate you taking the time and just kind of cutting out a little chunk of it to come on to WICC, because I do think this is an interesting story, Fran. I don't know if people missed it or realize that starting in January, it's not going to be required. However, it's being encouraged that teachers across Connecticut bring back cursive writing. Now, let's backtrack a quick second, Fran. When did it stop being a requirement to teach cursive?
Well, that's what, you know, that's what puzzles me about the legislation. And it also, it puzzles me because the thing is, we never took it out of the curriculum, Melissa. It's always been in the curriculum. We just have never in many, many years, because of the, you know, computers and typing and all of that, we've just never emphasized it.
That's so funny. So it's still in the curriculum. It's just not required.
It's just not, you know, it's not a requirement like it was. You know, I mean, I remember teaching cursive writing. You taught it every day and the letters had to be perfect and all of that. I'll tell you what I think. For what it's worth, Melissa, I think it remains in the curriculum. I think it should be in the curriculum. I don't think it should be emphasized in the way it was when I taught, or in the way it was certainly when I went to school. It was, you know, day in and day out, we did our cursive and it had to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, but however, I do think that our children should be exposed to it. Just as they're exposed to printing, I think they should be exposed to cursive writing as well. You just never know the chance that you're going to need it, or that you're going to need to read somebody else's cursive writing.
Yes.
So I think it's one of those things that needs to continue to be in the curriculum. I would probably spend some time on it every week, forming the letters and having the kids form it. But I wouldn't make it the priority that it has been.
Right. It used to be like its own course. I mean, when I was growing up, it was its own course. It was like cursive writing at 2:30. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. Every day.
The drills. Writing. Oh, man.
And you had a notebook, if you remember, with the paper that had the dotted line in the middle.
The tracing, so, and then try it on your own. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
So I just laugh. I mean, we grow and we move on, you know. I mean, I thought a lot about it after you asked me to be on the show because, you know, certainly I have lovely cursive writing. I really do. But guess what? I taught myself to type. I couldn't type. I never learned it.
I guess that's what's interesting about it. And again, we have Fran Rabinowitz here. I love to get Fran's perspective on things because she's been in so many different sectors of education in Connecticut over the years, and she is now the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. And so I love to get her perspective on these stories. And I was reading about this law that goes into effect, which is basically just reiterating that, hey, cursive writing is there and we should be teaching our kids that, but it's not required.
Right.
And so what's interesting about it, Fran, is, of course, sometimes I will go to, you know, the past and I'll say, oh, you know, these kids, you're right. I have that mentality of like, these kids should be learning. And it's so sad that no one knows how to do their signature anymore. Yada, da, da, da. But then I think about it, to be honest, and I think about, you know, what do you use cursive writing for? You use it for a signature, really. I mean, because even the idea of reading someone's cursive is kind of a dying art. People don't even write letters anymore. It's sad. It's awful. But that's the reality we sort of live in. And so I'm wondering, because we've now started to require courses in handling finances. That's like a big thing in Connecticut this year, was that they were launching finance classes for high schoolers. I feel like cursive should be something like that, where it's something you're going to need in your adult life when you need to sign off on things, whatever that may be. And it's sort of a skill that you would learn when you're older and it could be appreciated, like a high schooler. I don't know what you think about that.
I do think it is something that it should be part of the repertoire. Let's just put it that way. And I just would never say it should be emphasized the way it was in the past, because we've moved on and we've evolved, and I just don't think that, you know, there's going to be that need for it to spend that much time on it. But I do think kids should be able to sign their name in cursive, and I think they ought to be able to recognize cursive writing when they see it. You know, I mean, it's funny, you say no letters or that kind of thing. Well, I send Christmas cards, and so, you know, I have my list on Excel, and, you know, I print out everything and the whole bit. But sometimes I get a card from someone and that I didn't send, and it's just easier for me to grab a pen and put their address on the card.
Absolutely. Totally agree with you. And I also love to write. Like, we still write in handwriting and all that thank you cards. I will not send out a text message or an email or post. I will not do that. I still believe in the art of letters and cards. I think there's something very special about that. But a lot of people don't. The majority of people don't.
No, the majority don't. But you're absolutely right, because I feel the same way. I feel that it is incredibly important. You know, a thank you note. You know, I sit on the board of a nonprofit. I just wrote 18 thank you notes to donors, and somehow or other writing them and I'm sure receiving them saying, hey, you know, your gift is really important to us, and it's so important that I'm taking this time to personally write you a note. I just think it matters.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Fran. We have Fran Rabinowitz here, who is the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. We were just talking about cursive writing and just in general having curriculum surrounding etiquette. And I was curious, Fran, what your thoughts were on incorporating more etiquette classes. Like, I think about in high school how you can take, I mean, I guess you could take them more like electives when you get into college. But in high school, I remember being a senior and you got free periods, right? And you could either take extra art classes or you could take extra whatever classes. And I'm wondering the idea of etiquette. So we've now made it a requirement for a lot of high schools to have finance, which is very good for people to start budgeting and learning how to balance a checkbook, even though we don't do that anymore. You know, knowing how to be financially responsible before you go to college. What about etiquette, though? Because I do find that there are a lot of lost arts from past generations that we're just not teaching. And unfortunately, generations are beginning to wither, to put it simply.
You know, you raised such an interesting point, Melissa. You know, I do believe that the first place for etiquette and things like thank you notes and showing your gratitude, it does begin with the family. I do believe that. I think it's a value that the family, thankfully, many families teach their children how important it is to show gratitude, no matter if it's a dollar gift or if it's a $100 gift. And I think that that is incredibly important. As we move forward, though, I think with etiquette, you know, I'm thinking about high schools, and I'm always on this campaign that high schools probably need to do some things differently, because we're not reaching every child and filling every need. And I'm not sure that we can ever do that, but we have to keep trying. And one of the things that I do believe is we have to equip our high school students with being able to enter the workforce after high school, whether that's part-time to put themselves through college.
Or a gap year, or if people are going, if they're not even going to college, because that's becoming more and more common. I agree, Fran. That's what kind of made me think about it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so etiquette fits in there. I'm not quite sure we call it etiquette or what we call it, but I do believe our high school kids need to know how to interview, how to make eye contact, how to
public speaking, how to address. I mean, this sounds crazy, Fran, but how to even shake hands. I mean, there. I just think that there are things that I too many times, and thankfully there were some courses in college that were helpful, but if there are kids who are not going to college or not getting that opportunity, I mean, but a lot of times, a lot of my experience came from internships, for example, where I learned what was appropriate, what are good conversation starters with another colleague, what is appropriate behavior, what is appropriate dress. I mean, things like that. Are a lot of times you're sort of just kind of figuring it out. And I don't know. I just think that is something that if I were a senior in high school, you know, again, I'm dating myself, but 15, 20 years ago, I would have loved to have taken, you know, a class. I don't know what you'd call it. Maybe not etiquette, but it's like prep for the world 101. But I would have loved to have taken that. Yes.
Absolutely, Melissa. And I just think you raised an interesting point. I think it is really important. You know, we used to call it dress for success or whatever, but I do think that that's important. I mean, it's amazing. I haven't had many instances, but when I was a superintendent, someone showed up for a interview with me for a physical education job, and he came in shorts and a T-shirt, and I wouldn't interview.
Right.
I said, that's just not the way you dress for an interview. And, you know, he called and we talked and so on and so forth, and he came back. But it was like, no, an interview is important. You dress properly and, you know, you don't come in shorts and a T-shirt.
Right. So, well, and even sending that follow-up email, and this is where it sort of worries me a little bit, is I have met people who are not planning. I mean, I have interns all the time at WICC. I had them in TV, too. Yep. And I remember having a past intern. This was years ago. And I remember when they were graduating high school, and I said, "Are you going to college?" "No, we're not going. I'm not going to college. I'm doing a skip year." "Cool, no worries. That's great. What are your plans?" "I don't know." And they said, "I would really love the opportunity to maybe like interview to be a street teamer." "Great, you should." He sits down. He meets my boss. "Great, whatever." And comes into work the next week. I said, "How did your interview go?" "Great, blah, blah, blah." I said, "You emailed him after, right? You emailed him to thank him, for taking the time to talk to you." "No, why would I do that?" And I thought, oh, man, I mean, and so these are things that unless you're being taught, a lot of times kids just don't know. They don't know what the proper protocols are, you know, going back to like writing thank you cards. If it's not being taught at home, or you come from a broken home, or you're not being taught those things, not to put more on schools, that's not what I'm trying to do. But I do think that is a course that I think any student would benefit from. And I bet you a lot of students would sign up for it, too, because I remember being anxiety riddled junior and senior in high school, wondering how in the world am I going to make it in this place? How do I fit
Absolutely.
In? You know, I think that'd be helpful.
Yeah, and I don't think it's instinctual in people. You know,
you've
just made me think of so many things. You know, like I remember being in a school district where, you know, after you interviewed, I believe after you interview for any position, everybody should hear from you.
Yes,
you know
I agree.
I mean?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, you know, at this time you were not a candidate, but they need to hear back. They need that closure.
Thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you so much for even considering me. And I hope in the future, if you ever have any opportunities, yes.
And it's important for the district or the company to also reach out to those people and say, "We hired someone else, but thank you for your interest."
Because
and
you're right. Even that etiquette is lacking sometimes. Absolutely.
It is. It's truly lacking. So I'd love to think about that more.
Cool. Well, I just gave you something to think about for 2024, Fran, as if you weren't busy enough.
It's okay. I can always learn new things and think about new things.
That's how you know you're talking to an educator right there. Fran Rabinowitz, I want to thank you so much again for coming on during such a busy time and for giving us the time constantly on WICC. And I do hope that you'll continue to come on in the new year.
Of course, Melissa. I hope you continue to ask me because I just think you ask the most wonderful questions.
Oh, man.
And you wonder about the right things. So,
thank you, Fran. I appreciate
thank
you, Fran.
You.
Yes, you are welcome back anytime. Fran Rabinowitz, the Executive Director for the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents right here on WICC. She will definitely be back in 2024. I can promise you that. Earlier this week, we came across a pretty big announcement that hundreds of Fairfield County students will soon have access to the support and opportunities they need to thrive, thanks to a lot of money in funding, which was announced by the Fairfield County Business Collaborative for Education Equity. I don't know much about this group, and I would love to know more about the funding because it's a good chunk of change. Joining us now is Carol Heller, who is the Senior Vice President and Market Executive for Bank of America in Southern Connecticut, and that is one of the seven founders of the Fairfield County Business Collaborative. And so I want to thank you so much, Carol, for taking the time to come on, especially during the holidays. We really appreciate it. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Excited to be here and a big, big announcement for Fairfield County Nonprofits.
So first of all, before we talk about the major announcement, tell me a little bit more about Fairfield County Business Collaborative, because I'm not too familiar with it.
Sure. Well, back in 2020, seven businesses came together along with Fairfield County's Community Foundation as the organizing entity to form this group that was focused on helping reduce and eliminate educational disparities amongst Fairfield County's most vulnerable kids, pre-K to post-high school, and really helping these students, their parents, their guardians, and teachers thrive. It's a big focus of this collaborative. So businesses coming together, led by Fairfield County's Community Foundation, to create impact and opportunity for local kids.
That's really neat. How long has it been around?
Well, it was formed in 2020, and we're now 13 businesses strong. We're open to all businesses of all sizes to join. So I'm happy to tell you this is Bank of America, which I represent, First County Bank, the Latin Point Capital, Tinkle, Lapine Associates, Pitney Bowes, Synchrony, the Ashforth Company, the Tudor Foundation, Xerox, FactSet Charitable Foundation, Little John & Company, and McKinsey & Company have all come together. These are current partners who are investing in local kids, their education, and making sure they have access and opportunity in the educational field to thrive and to succeed locally and to stay locally and have successful careers. Very exciting.
It is really exciting. And I know that a lot of businesses love to give back, especially to their local communities. But I'm curious, when you are giving these kids the opportunity to really thrive educationally, do you keep those connections with schools, for example, so that you can also potentially employ some of these students once they graduate and have degrees?
Absolutely. And, you know, we're investing. We've been doing this since 2020. This round, we're investing nearly $350,000. We're really going deep in investing in six area nonprofits, and these are well-established nonprofits. And a big focus of this funding round is working with nonprofits that are partnering and collaborating on projects. So these aren't individual nonprofits. These are nonprofits that are doing work across the community with many partners. And again, the focus is pre-K to 12-plus, helping students succeed in the classroom and really develop the skills to pursue successful careers. So it's the full range from pre-K on to college and making sure that when kids graduate from high school, first of all, they do graduate. And oftentimes kids don't have those opportunities or don't foresee going on to college or a specific career. And we want to arm them with the tools and education, all students, and give them all equitable access to those tools and education in order to succeed.
Absolutely. And again, we have Carol Heller here, who is the Senior Vice President and Market Executive for Bank of America in Southern Connecticut. And the reason that Carol is here is because Bank of America in Southern Connecticut is actually one of the seven founders of the Fairfield County Business Collaborative, which is working to equip students, hundreds of students in Fairfield County, with the tools and opportunities they need in order to get an equitable education, just like any other kid should get, and be able to succeed in their futures. Do you mind listing the nonprofits that this money is specifically going to be going towards?
Sure, I'll give you a couple examples. First is Stanford Cradle to Career, and this is a broad nonprofit collaborative based in Stanford that's partnering with Building One Community in Stanford, and they're looking to focus on advancing early childhood education in the Stanford area, but they're also sharing their learnings with Bridgeport and Danbury. And that's a big focus of this collaborative, is working with those, you know, urban areas and areas where we have most vulnerable students. So Stanford Cradle to Career works with community partners, with educational partners, with municipal partners, faith-based organizations, and parents and families in order to really build opportunity in the Stanford area. Another example is an organization called Today's Students, Tomorrow's Teachers, and they're partnering with Norwalk Public Schools, and they're looking to support and expand opportunities for 150 culturally diverse and economically challenged families in high school and even college students to complete their education, move on, and become employed in local communities as educators and professionals. So that's a group that's working with kids that may have careers as teachers, but we're working on a number of different career opportunities, and all partners are really invested in saying, we want to invest in education to help these kids develop the skills and then come back and work with us locally. So absolutely.
I'm curious, Carol. I think this is wonderful. How do you decide which nonprofits are going to benefit from this money?
Well, it is we have 13 organizations who are partners or investors in this work. We do have a periodic RFP that goes out to nonprofits. Many nonprofits across the region, giving them the opportunity to position themselves. And in this round, we're really making larger, more deeper, more impactful grants to organizations that have demonstrated success, but are also proving that they're looking to collaborate and partner with multiple nonprofits across the region to create impact.
Carol Heller is here, Senior Vice President and Market Executive for Bank of America in Southern Connecticut, which is one of the seven founders of the Fairfield County Business Collaborative. Carol, this probably sounds like a dumb question, but the money, the $347,500, which we're about to talk about, did all the businesses involved with this collaborative, did you guys all just kind of come in on that money? Where'd that money come from?
It came from the business investors. That's right.
Okay.
We've made multiple commitments to supporting investments in these nonprofits. And this is a long-term commitment for us to invest in our local community and help our community thrive, and especially our kids.
Yeah, I think it's great. I love it. I just wanted to make sure I knew where the money was coming from. And so $347,500 certainly can go a very long way. Now, I know this went to six nonprofits that you had mentioned before, but talk to us, if you don't mind. Give us either some examples or some specifics. Like, what is this money specifically going to do for these hundreds of kids?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the organizations that I mentioned is Stanford Cradle to Career, which works with nonprofits across the city. It's a broad collaboration with the United Way and others involved. It's working with Building One Community. And Building One Community works with culturally diverse kids. So they're linguistic barriers. These are kids that we are helping to advance early childhood education. So really kind of help them in a comfortable environment, have linguistic support or mentoring or educational help and support in order for them to succeed at a young age and give them a strong start to education so they can succeed through middle school and high school. And it's really making sure that they have those deep supports. And some of these may be immigrant families who really need that additional help, linguistic help and support in order to be comfortable and successful in school. And they were sharing learnings, as I mentioned, with Bridgeport and Danbury. Another organization I mentioned was Today's Students, Tomorrow's Teachers. And these are working with high school and college students who may not know the career track, may be interested in education. And we know there are so many opportunities in healthcare and for teachers and so many openings. So we want to be sure to give those kids that may not have thought of those careers, introduce them to opportunities early and give them mentors and really start giving them educational tools in order to be successful on that career pathway. So it's really exposing them to skill sets and helping bolster their skill sets in order to complete high school and to develop the skills and training needed in order to be successful teachers that come back and teach in our local communities.
I think another one here, which is really neat, you know, because obviously we love to give back to the future. We want to build them up as much as possible. But one of the groups here is a very recognizable one, Sound Waters, a pilot. Yeah. I guess this money will pilot a program to introduce high school students to key trade skills for marine trade jobs. And I know just from doing a little bit of research from them, don't they also work to protect and preserve Long Island Sound, like the work that these kids are doing?
They do amazing work, and you know we love them, we support them. But they don't just do educational work, or they don't just do environmental work. They do a lot to clean up the sound, and the sound has come a long way. And they do a lot of educational tours and exposure for kids and adults, and all kinds of great things for the sound. But they're also training individuals that may be interested in a marine career opportunity, and there are a lot of great career opportunities there. These are kids that may not have seen themselves as going off to college, but are interested in the environment and the waterfront and their terrific marine careers. So we're really helping define those and hone those skill sets in order to go into what may be non-traditional careers or traditional careers like healthcare and education. Mm-hmm. But it's providing those pathways and those tools and that mentoring and support in order to help kids find those pathways.
Carol Heller, I think this is wonderful. I love that local businesses helping local students came together 3 years ago and continuing to give money to their futures and to build up the next generation of workers through giving them more education opportunities here in Southern Connecticut. What is your website if people want to learn more about the groups who make up this entire organization, or also they want to see the nonprofits that are benefiting, they want to learn more about the work that you're doing?
Yeah, anyone that's interested in other businesses or nonprofits or individuals can go to fccfoundation.org. So fccfoundation.org. And that's Fairfield County's Community Foundation. And they are the lead organizer for the Fairfield County Business Collaborative for Education Equity. And we do invite businesses of all sizes to join us. We are building and growing and making a real significant impact locally.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So not only do you get to learn about what this current group is doing, but if you are a business owner and you want to get in on some of this great work, you can, you know, also check them out for that reason as well. And Carol, I want to thank you so much for making the time to come on, talk about this group and the work that's going into hundreds of students getting more opportunities with their education here in Southern Connecticut. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Melissa.
And I just want to reiterate, if you want that website, it's fccfoundation.org.